This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with Germanicus, Makovlejos. I'm Gaius. And we are by the Thames. It's a fall evening in Londinium in 90 AD. Domitian is our emperor. He's very unpopular. We know he will come to a hard end. We know that emperors come to hard ends. In the first century AD, which is remarkable for the success of the Roman Empire as it grows to its fullest reach in a few years from now, and in the beginning of the second century AD. However, that doesn't mean that all goes well for the emperors. Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown. I think someone in the 16th century will write that line. It still matters here. And so, Germanicus, I remind the listener in the 21st century that wishing the end of Putin, or planning the end of Putin, or what happens if Putin goes, or aren't they discussing it among the nomenklatura, old term for the elite of Moscow, or what about the general staff that sees it given opportunity and then broken and sent from the field, or shot on the field? What about, aren't they talking the way, say, the German army talked in 1944 when the dictator wouldn't let them fall back from Normandy and hold a defensive line? Same thing in Russia in 1942-43, wouldn't let them fall back. Didn't they talk about replacing this dictator with someone who can come to terms with the real threat? In 1944, the real threat was the Soviet Union, according to the Germans. In Rome, the real threat would either be, well, pick your figure. It would be the cruelty of the emperor or the waste of the legions on the Danube or this foolishness about wanting to replace the Julian line with some leading general, which came to pass, by the way. We know that's why we're living with the Flavians. So my memory of emperors in the first century, that what we've lived through, Germanicus, is that it goes very badly and that you begin to wish that we could have back the old bad boy, because at least you could predict what was going to happen tomorrow. With the transition, you don't know who's going to wind up emperor. Vespasian put it best when he assumed the purple following the year of four emperors. He said, the sovereign power is a matter of fate, and fate is extremely scary to wait on. So do you measure that this wishing for if only Putin would go is thought through? Are the Americans, are the French, are the British, are the NATO countries aware that what will follow an emperor's departure is instability?
A few people understand that, but America is wrought up in wrath, as they used to say in Anglo-Saxon. We're frothing with wrath. And the hatred of Putin leads to wish fulfillment, and it leads to the sort of desirous projection that will satisfy the American hatred of Russia and the desire to defeat Russia and bring it down. But those projections may not accord with actual reality. Now, there might be situations in which Putin could be forced to retire, let's say. But that would be in all probability if he mismanages the war badly and people pin that mismanagement on him. Right now, that's not happening. And the setbacks that Russia has received are minor in the context of actually winning the war. But at some point, there has to be a satisfying outcome for Russians. Putin has to fulfill the expectations that he himself created through his actions in the early part of this century, and which have led people to believe in him, trust him. And that could come to an end with a bungling of the big offensive, for example. But right now, if Russia is at war, which means it is committed to, and Russians believe in the struggle and understand what will happen to Russia if they lose, the only direction that can create a dynamic that topples Putin would have to be from further mismanagement of the war or unwillingness to properly pursue the war. And if Putin was seen as faltering, those who would succeed him are going to be even more intolerant of weakness and pusillanimity. They're going to want an all-out war. And you can take, for example, Dmitry Medvedev, who was seen as a more liberal leader than Putin, and actually engaged in all sorts of nice conversations, say, with President Obama. But just recently, he made a public statement. It was actually just a couple days ago. And he said, quote, "It is useless and unnecessary to appeal to the prudence of our enemies in the West. The enemies must be forced to ask for mercy in the lost economic battle and end it with their complete and unconditional surrender." And so one of the differences between the more recent legacies of war that both we and the Russians have that differ from the expectations that Imperial Romans had is that Imperial Rome, especially in the Flavian period that we inhabit, is one of relative security in which the emperor's executive is leader of a professional army that does the work of maintaining security, imperial security. But we come from a 20th century legacy of the entire nation engaged in a battle. And Russia, I think, is more closely approximate to that state of mind, while the U.S. is living in a kind of fantasy world in which our reality is Roman and focuses on Roman-style imperial defense with a very small professional army, while at the same time believing that that army is invincible and can do anything and has magical capabilities, like, say, HIMARS or Starlink. And so it's a contest of two different visions of the nation. And in this contest, we, and certainly Europe, are by far the weaker in our ability to claim the commitment and allegiance of the people. And so in Russia, a new leader could only come if Russia faces defeat. And I don't think that is at all likely, but that would be the one way in which Mr. Putin would have to exit the stage.
Exit the stage. Let's be detailed here, Germanicus. Emperors do not retire. Emperors leave. And it's not seen as logical. It is a surprise. The forces who oppose the emperor close in on him. Look at Nero. Nero was arbitrary and cruel, but a great builder. There was lots to say for him. He kept the money flowing into the hands of those who would turn Rome into a marvel. And he built very well. So did some of the other cruel emperors. So part of the culture celebrated him. Part of the culture that was most at risk, of course, were the high and mighty Senate class and the generals who disappointed him. However, at the end, they closed in on him. He wasn't sure who was going to get him. He was told that they would torture him to death. He was frightened. And so he tried to kill himself. He failed. He asked for help from one of his servants. It was a miserable end. And what replaced him, of course, was total chaos, the year of four emperors. That is a more likely possibility than an agreed-upon Kerensky riding his horse into the palace and taking over the reins of liberal Russia.
One of the problems that the Tsar had in World War One was that he took personal command of the armies and moved close to the battle line. And when Russia's armies were cracking at the end of 1916 and early 1917, he was blamed by Russians. Mr. Putin has so far avoided that. However, Roman emperors who are engaged in a war that either goes badly or has the potential for existential symbolism to emerge are often done away with. In our own time, Domitian is facing the forces of Dacia, and he is not handling that with real assurance. We know, however, that after our time, Trajan will be able to completely crush Dacia, which was a real threat to Rome, and he benefited from it enormously. He became another illustri and ultimately a god. So things hang on an edge. The Emperor Maurice, several hundreds of years after us, in the year 600, was not able to keep the army's allegiance fighting the Slavic hordes, literally, across the Danube River, and forced the army to stay in winter quarters north of the Danube, and they didn't like that. And so he was, and his five sons were brutally murdered shortly thereafter. So I do think that the nature of this war, which is seen by Russia as an existential struggle, is going to be the deciding factor in terms of whether or not Mr. Putin falls. And if he does fall, history is unanimous in saying that the fall won't be gentle and probably not even disguised. But that point has not yet arrived, and it's not going to arrive without a very palpable blow to Russia, not just its pride, but to its sense of its own destiny, its own fate, meaning here, glorious fate. It will not stand being deprived of that. And of course, that's what the United States thought would happen very quickly after it lowered the boom with sanctions, and it didn't. The opposite happened. So in a sense, this is a time of great danger because a powerful Western victory, which I consider unlikely, but one that could eventually come to pass, at least in terms of the West misjudging and escalating beyond what it can actually achieve in Ukraine, or a complete and decisive Russian victory, which I consider more likely, but also equally dangerous, because I don't think the U.S. is willing to abide by a glorious Russian victory, say, that looks like Tannenberg in 1914. We won't abide by that. So it's a very strange situation. And I consider it one of actual great danger for those two structural reasons. I mean, there's no basis for expecting that the situation will remain stalemated, or the stalemate itself will be so impossible to overcome that both sides are exhausted and agree to an outcome that gives each side something of what it wants. That is, I think, less likely, and more likely is a decisive Russian victory, or the U.S. escalating the war to forestall a decisive Russian victory. Those are very dangerous moments that we can expect will arrive at our door in the next several months.
Germanicus is Michael Vlahos. I am John Bachelor Gaius. We're entertaining something that we can't see. We can see 2,000 years, but we can't see the immediate outcome of the Russian-Ukrainian NATO-Russian conflict. It's a world at war. And what we can contribute from the first century AD is that there are no limits when Rome is involved. And equally for Russia, there are no limits when Russia is involved. They do very badly for a long time, and then fate decides the outcome. We're off to the theater, however, to entertain ourselves. Remember, I told you, there's a very famous actor in town from Rome, a pantomime. He got into trouble, the way actors do, with the emperor Domitian. Our emperors in the first century AD are very discerning about the theater. They insist that theatrical people obey rules. And when they wander outside of those rules, they are punished. This particular famous actor was actually scourged, whipped, by order of the emperor, similar to what Augustus ordered an actor once whipped because he had decided that in order to entertain himself, he was going to disguise a young woman as a boy to have her serve him his food, violating what Augustus believed was the proper way theater people should carry on. No women backstage. That was then. This is now. We're going to go off and watch this famous actor. He's touring, trying to get his way back to Rome. We're going to sacrifice to the great god Augustus and enjoy our evening, and we wish the same to you all. I'm John Batchelor.